Today is Thursday, February 21st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, reports that the special counsel could give his final report on the Russia investigation as soon as next week.
If Mr. Trump is counting on Mr. Barr to go easy on him just because he likes him, I think that's a vain hope. I don't believe that Bill would jeopardize his reputation for this president or any other president.
Russia's president threatens the U.S. to not put missiles in Europe. Accusations of possible war crimes and gross human rights violations in South Sudan. Also ahead, a pop star is getting hotter by the day. CNN is reporting that the U.S. Department of Justice may announce as early as next week that Special Counsel Robert Mueller will finish his report on the Russia investigation. U.S. Attorney General William Barr is expected to review Mueller's findings and then give his own summary to Congress. Democrats have been concerned that Barr will choose to limit disclosure to Congress and the public. Mueller is investigating alleged Russian meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and possible collusion by U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign, as well as possible obstruction of justice by the president. Trump has repeatedly called the investigation a witch hunt. Joining us to discuss is George Mason University Professor of Public Policy, Robert Deitz. Thanks for being with us. So if correct that the report will be finished next week, how soon might we hear anything about what is in it?
I think it'd be quite a while, because I suspect what he would do, he and his staff, is set forth a summary of the findings. And he needs to decide a very important issue. When he was testifying, he was asked to commit to releasing the report to the public. He qualified and said he, you know, is in favor of transparency, et cetera, but would release the report only to the extent allowed by law. By tradition, grand jury reports are secret. The idea is that if you're indicted, that will become public. But if you've been investigated and not indicted, it's unfair to release a report that trashes you with the conclusion that, no, we're not going to indict him. And that could well be true here. He could, for example, put out a lot of information about the president, possible presidential relations with Russians, et cetera, but at the end of the day conclude that none of this was illegal or indictable. It'd be very unfair to the president or any other potential defendant to basically be thoroughly trashed only to end up saying, no, we're not going to indict you. Please.
How likely is it that we will get the answers to the main question when this whole thing started, which was as to whether the Trump campaign was working with the Russians to influence the 2016 election?
I think we're going to get a fair amount on that, in large measure because many of the people that Mr. Mueller was looking at have been indicted and or pled guilty and or found guilty, and that's public information. So I think we'll learn a lot about the contours of it. What we may not find out much about is conversations among the innermost Trump circle, that is, Mr. Trump, Jr., Kushner, etc. I still am skeptical that the report is coming out as quickly as people at Justice seem to think it is. I'm still expecting a couple of more indictments, but I could well be wrong.
If it's true that this report is coming out next week, would that mean that there are no more indictments related to the investigation?
In all likelihood, it's possible that the referrals to prosecutors in the Southern District and in D.C. could come up with their own indictments, but I think that's unlikely.
As far as those investigations, those were some that Mueller referred, certain matters that fell outside the scope of the Russia probe.
Correct.
To these other attorneys. Will those continue?
I don't know if they'll continue, but the conclusion of a Mueller report does not ipso facto mean they're going away.
Is it possible that some of these investigations really haven't even come to light to the public?
Sure. And what I have found really remarkable about the Mueller investigation is how tight an investigation it's been. We've had very, very little leakage from the Mueller team, if any.
And then, of course, there's speculation about the indicting of a president and the fact that it's a Justice Department rule, but it's not a constitutional law.
At this stage, correct. It's not been litigated.
There has been speculation that the president picked this particular attorney general because he had written some negative thoughts about the entire investigation. And I would imagine the president, who is not a fan of this investigation, is sort of hoping or counting on this attorney general, Bill Barr, to put an end to it as quickly as possible. Could that be why we're hearing about this?
If Mr. Trump is counting on Mr. Barr to go easy on him just because he likes him, I think that's a vain hope. Bill Barr, yes, he's conservative, but he was a very good attorney general. He's a very good lawyer. He, I'm sure, is financially well set enough. He's not worried about the financial future. And I don't believe the bill would jeopardize his reputation for this president or any other president for that matter.
All right. That's George Mason University Professor of Public Policy, Robert Deitz. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin had a stern warning on Wednesday for Washington to ditch plans to install missiles in Europe. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Putin has sternly warned the US against the deployment, saying Russia will retaliate by fielding new weapons that will take just as little time to reach their targets. While the Russian leader didn't say what specific new weapons Moscow could deploy, his statement further raised the ante in tense relations with Washington. Speaking in his State of the Nation address, Putin charged that the US had abandoned a key arms control pact to free up its hand to build new missiles and tried to shift the blame for the move to Russia. I'm Charles Ledesma.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is the latest entrant into the increasingly crowded Democratic presidential field for 2020. Sanders and several other Democrats in the race advocate progressive views on key issues like the economy, the environment, and health care. In response, President Trump and several Republicans have charged that the Democratic Party is heading down the road of socialism, setting the stage for what could be a major ideological debate next year. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
From Kamala Harris to Cory Booker to Elizabeth Warren, Democratic presidential contenders are getting voters fired up on the campaign trail.
We can win this fight! Dream big! Fight hard and win!
Trump is a danger for the future of our country.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-described Democratic socialist, is the latest to join the Democratic field.
Our campaign is about creating a government and economy that works for the many, not just the few.
That progressive energy is also evident with new Democratic members of Congress, like New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, pushing a sweeping new environmental plan.
And I am so incredibly excited that we are going to transition this country into the future, and we are not going to be dragged behind by our past.
But the Democrats' emphasis on far-reaching plans for the environment, taxes on the wealthy, and expanding government health care programs is drawing fire from Republicans and from President Donald Trump on the campaign trail.
Yet there are those trying to implement socialism right here in the United States. So I again say to you, and I say it for the world to hear, America will never be a socialist country. Never, never.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the lively debate is all part of belonging to a broad party.
Welcome to the Democratic Party. We are not a rubber stamp for anybody. We are not a monolith. We never have been. And who would want to lead a party that would be described that way?
Democrats have long had a reputation for ideological splits and infighting, says analyst Larry Sabato.
The humorist Will Rogers said it best way back in the 1920s. He said, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And we're seeing that again. There are so many factions in the Democratic Party, and they're all being represented by a candidate or two or three.
Democratic voters will be looking for certain qualities as they choose a presidential nominee next year, says Elaine Kmark.
Kind of young and aggressive and can, you know, has enough gravitas, however, to deal with the challenges in front of the country. They're going to be looking at somebody who's really unlike Donald Trump.
But many Democrats will be most interested in finding a candidate who can beat the president, says Jim Kessler.
If a candidate goes too far left with a Bernie Sanders type agenda, I think that candidate is vulnerable to losing to Donald Trump. And I don't think that's where a lot of Democrats are substantively, and I don't think that's where they are politically.
Former Vice President Joe Biden and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, both centrists, could join the Democratic presidential field in the near future, ensuring a lively debate in the upcoming primaries. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Can Trump defeat his national emergency challengers? A U.S. investor detained in Russia may be denied consular access. U.S. trade representative to testify on China next week. And magnetic therapy can relieve depression. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A recent terrorist attack in the hotly contested Kashmir region is threatening to become a flashpoint between rivals India and Pakistan. The suicide attack on Indian security forces serving Kashmir in Kashmir killed dozens, with an Islamist group operating within Pakistan claiming responsibility. Margaret Bashir, VOA UN correspondent, talked to Doug Bernard about both the Indian and Pakistani UN ambassadors pointing fingers and waiting for the other side to act.
So there was an attack on Indian security forces in the disputed Kashmir territory of Jammu and Kashmir, and 40 Indian security personnel were killed. It was a huge attack. The terrorist group Jaish-e-Mohammed, also known as JEM, has claimed responsibility for it, and according to the United Nations, Jaish-e-Mohammed is a listed terrorist group that is based in Pakistan. So the Indian government is very upset about it, and Pakistan is saying it's not our fault. So this has heightened tensions between these two countries that have a history of difficult neighborly relations, and it's complicated by the fact that they're both nuclear power countries.
I understand that India is not just very upset, but that they've taken steps to respond. Is that correct?
I just spoke with the Indian ambassador to the United Nations a couple of hours ago here in our studio in New York, and I asked him if, you know, India has said they're going to make a jaw-breaking response. The rhetoric has been very strong from the Indian government. I asked him, is a military response from India, is that on the table? And he said, you know, I don't know where you got this idea. And look at the statements we've made. Yes, we've said we'll respond, but we've said things that we will take into account, and I can get into that in a minute. And he said, and we're awaiting those responses. We're a responsible state. It's not our tradition to respond in haste, but we will respond in a manner and in a way we decide to respond. So it sounds like they're waiting for Pakistan to take some action. They've said they want Pakistan to stop allowing JEM to use its territory to carry out and plan attack. They've also said that they want the international community to denounce terrorism, the clearly condemned terrorist act, and they want them to list leaders of these terrorist groups. There's a guy named Masood Azhar, who's the leader of Jaish-e-Mohammed, and there's buzz that they would like the UN to list him on their list of terrorists. So perhaps if they get sort of these steps, that might diffuse their response a bit.
My understanding is you've also spoken with the Pakistani ambassador. What are they saying?
Ambassador Malia Lodi, the ambassador of Pakistan, she told VOA on Tuesday that they want dialogue with India, but India has this policy of stop the terror and then we'll talk. And she's saying that we think that's really irresponsible, especially in such a fraught situation. We think we have to have dialogue. And as far as Pakistan's checkered history with terrorism, I mean, they had Osama bin Laden living in their country for over a decade. She says, no, we're victims of terrorism too, and we're working to stop it. And our prime minister has said he won't allow terrorists to use our territory. So she denies that they are responsible for this. There's always concern when two nuclear-powered nations are mad at each other. There's always concern. The Secretary General issued a second statement on Wednesday condemning the attack. This time he was calling for both governments of India and Pakistan to exercise maximum restraint to ensure the situation does not further deteriorate.
All right, that's VOA's Margaret Bashir speaking from the UN. Meanwhile, a UN fact-finding mission in South Sudan has uncovered evidence of violence and gross violations of human rights that may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. The report by the three-member UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan will be submitted to the UN Human Rights Council on March 12th. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report covers the human rights situation in South Sudan in 2018, but Commission member Andrew Clapham says it is not possible to ignore the more recent atrocities occurring in the country. He says the Commission is particularly upset by reports of renewed fighting in the Yei River area in central Equatoria between the government and rebel National Salvation Front. He says thousands of civilians have been forcibly displaced following what he calls a scorched earth policy. He says the warring parties reportedly are attacking villages, torching homes, killing civilians, and raping women and girls.
With regards to the rest of the country, I suppose we are a little more hopeful. Following the signing of the revitalized agreement on the resolution of the conflict 5 months ago, but the situation in the Equatorias remains extremely volatile. We continue to conclude in our report that there have been human rights violations, including, again, rape and sexual violence, and we consider that those crimes could amount to war crimes.
Cases of rapes documented in November and December show a marked worsening of sexual violence in several South Sudanese states since the peace accord was signed. Clapham says the commission also has received reports of sexual violence against men and boys, but notes these crimes are underreported compared to those against women and girls because there is a greater level of stigma. The report finds that rights violations, including torture, arbitrary arrest, abductions, and sexual slavery, have become commonplace in South Sudan because nobody is held accountable. The commissioners warn that as long as impunity remains the norm, these atrocities and the violence that feeds upon them will continue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Can the United States and China step back from the brink of their trade war before President Trump imposes more tariffs on Chinese imports? We'll talk about the politics and substance of the trade talks with our special guest, Robert Daly, director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Wilson Center. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The Economist and Forbes have both named 2019 the year of the vegan, as more and more people are turning to plant-based diets. But as more people turn to non-dairy cheeses, milks, and butters, the dairy industry is fighting how the products can be labeled. It claims the labels confuse consumers who unknowingly buy products made from plants. But with dairy alternatives becoming more popular and sales increasing every year, advocates say the industry's argument is motivated by money. The labeling issue is being weighed by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration after ending a public comment period last month. Joining us to talk more about this is Miyoko Shinner, an outspoken advocate behind the fight over labels. So plant-based vegan diets are certainly becoming a major trend these days.
Absolutely, and it's a worldwide phenomenon. It's not just here in the United States. It's all over the world. Wherever you go, you find veganism popping up everywhere.
What do you think made the shift?
Well, I think social media has had a huge impact, but, you know, we really are just becoming more enlightened as a human race, I think, you know, and we're just becoming aware of all of these social issues, and one of the biggest social justice issues of our time is animal rights and what that's doing, actually, not only to animals, but to the destruction of the environment, to wildlife, to human health, to everything. And people are waking up. People are just getting smarter, and they're beginning to realize that they, too, can impact the future of food and create a world that's better for everybody.
And I just saw an article recently, and I believe it was The Economist, that said 2019 is the year of the vegan.
I'm going to push that even further. It's the decade of the vegan. It's the century of the veganism. This is the future.
I think people that haven't really made that change think that they just, how would I survive without milk or cheese? And for people that grew up on those types of things, they don't understand how it would be possible to still enjoy their meals. But that really has also come a long way, hasn't it?
It certainly has, you know, and you don't have to do away with those products anymore, because now you can find a plant dairy alternative. You can buy your milk, you can buy your cheese, you can buy whatever you want that you've enjoyed for your entire life that's come from animals, but now you can get it from plants. There was a study that showed that 52% of the people that actually regularly consume vegan or plant-based products do it because they think it tastes better. So there's a huge number of people, you know, I think most people know that a lot of people love almond milk, and baristas are saying they sell more almond or coconut milk than they do dairy milk now. So people are beginning to have their taste buds change, and they're beginning to enjoy these foods even more than the dairy counterpart.
And I would imagine more and more businesses, as the demand grows, will be popping up.
Oh, I think so. In fact, apparently there's more vegan claims than any other claim when you go to these food shows.
Well, you mentioned milk and you mentioned almond milk. My understanding is that the dairy industry has been really fighting hard for these products to not be able to be called milk or yogurt or cheese in their descriptions. And you have been working to get feedback and to try to fight for the right to continue to be able to use those terms as milk and yogurt and cheese.
Yes, that's absolutely right. There's something called the Standards of Identity that the FDA regulates. And it talks about what you can call certain foods. So many, many foods are regulated by these standards. And so milk is defined as the lacteal secretions of one or more healthy cows free of colostrum. We think that milk should have a wider definition, because for centuries, we've called things like coconut milk, or, hey, what about milk of magnesia, et cetera. So the dictionary definition is that, you know, it can be a milky fluid that comes from a plant or from animals. So we want to spread that definition to cover a wider range of products. Consumers do understand the difference. There was a lawsuit recently filed in some superior court. They lost. It was an almond milk lawsuit, and almond milk won. The judge basically said consumers were not confused. Consumers mm-hmm. were not buying almond milk thinking it was dairy milk. I'm a founding member of the Plant-Based Foods Association, which is a trade group that represents companies in the plant-based space. And we are taking these regulatory issues to heart, and we're going to Capitol Hill and lobbying and talking about the standards of identity and how they can potentially impact greatly the health and sales of these new products that are coming to market. You know, we are introducing this whole new category of foods, milk and cheese and all sorts of things made from plants. And we are going to have an uphill battle bringing these to market and succeeding if we aren't able to utilize certain terminology.
That's Miyoko Shinner, founder of Miyoko's Kitchen and an outspoken advocate behind a movement to raise awareness about the FDA's consideration of a label ban. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has nominated 8 movies in the category of Best Picture. One will get the coveted award. So what are the elements that make a movie the best picture of the year? VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with award-winning playwright, director, and founding director of AFI Silver Theater, Murray Horwitz, about the chances of some of this year's nominees making history in the 91st Academy Awards.
You have become close to Abigail.
She is a viper. You're jealous.
The Favourite, a dark comedy on scheming politics and power struggle during Queen Anne's royal court in the 18th century, and Roma, a nostalgic take on domestic help in a middle-class household in Mexico City, lead the pack with 10 Oscar nominations each. But the number of nominations does not guarantee the winner for Best Picture, considering 8,200 Academy members from different backgrounds are voting in the category, says playwright and director Murray Horwitz.
You may have a songwriter who wrote a song for one movie, won the Oscar, or was nominated for the Oscar, gets to vote now. I don't know if you're nominated, I think you get to vote. And so that person, who may not know anything about film, but is a great musician, gets to vote for Best Picture.
What's the lyric?
Horwitz says some vote for their friends, others for or against a studio production company. But those who look at the merits of a Best Picture, he says, traditionally they look at the film's cinematography, film editing, direction, and script. But not always.
Step into the spotlight. Wakanda forever!
If Black Panther won Best Picture, I wouldn't be upset.
Nominated for 7 Oscars, that would be a first for a superhero flick. But then again, Ryan Coogler's Black Panther is no ordinary superhero movie. Artistic acclaim aside, it has become a cultural phenomenon that celebrates the African and African-American identity. But how does it stack up next to the competition?
Rome is a kind of masterpiece. I mean, it really is. The things that it has to say about human dignity, about the value of human life, about our complacency in a middle-class or upper-middle-class environment, I mean, those things are all extremely powerful.
This is madness.
Sometimes a lady likes to have some fun.
And then there's the favorite, checking all the right nomination boxes.
I love the fact that The Favorite featured women in all the most significant roles.
A film's perspective on race may cost some of the contenders the coveted award. Though beautifully executed, 5 Oscar nominee Green Book, a moving dramedy about the bond between a real-life eclectic African-American music composer and his uncouth white driver during a music tour in the South during the Jim Crow era, has been criticized for whitewashing America's dark historic period.
I'm very sympathetic to people who have said, and I agree with people who said, Green Book is a movie that makes white people feel good about themselves.
On the other hand, says Horowitz, Spike Lee's 6 Oscar nominee, Black Klansman, a blistering satire on racism in America, has been criticized by some for over-politicizing the 1970s real-life story of an African-American cop infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan, alluding to today's political climate.
America first. America first.
This could alienate voters who may not be on message.
Is this the real life?
Ultimately, Mari Horowitz says, the Oscar for Best Picture should be greater than its performers, its music, its script, its cinematography, and its impact. It should be all of the above. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, in music news, this artist has been compared to Mariah Carey for her incredible vocal range, and those talents are more than paying off. Singer, songwriter, and actress Ariana Grande is on fire. She's achieved something no other artist since the Beatles in 1964 have been able to do. This week, 3 of her songs are the numbers 1, 2, and 3 on Billboard's Hot 100 list. The songs include 7 Rings, Break Up With Your Girlfriend, I'm Bored, and Thank You. Grande is also the first artist to have the lead singles from each of their first 5 studio albums debut in the top 10 on U.S. charts.
I got it, I want it, I got it, I want it, I got it. You like my hair? Gee, thanks, just bought it. I see it, I like it, I want it.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
They say which one I say now. I want all of them. Happiness is the same price as red bottoms.
My smile is beaming. My skin is gleaming. The way it shines. You see me, I bought a crib, just for the closet, both his and hers. I want it, I got it, 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 I want it, I got it. You like my hair? Gee, thanks, just bought it. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it.
My receipts be looking like phone numbers. If it ain't money, then wrong number. Black card is my business card. The way it be setting the tone for me. I don't need a brave, but I be like, put it in the bag, yeah. When you see the max, they stacked up like my ass, yeah. Go from the store to the booth, make it all back in one loop. Give me the loot, never mind, I got the juice. Nothing but never we shoot. Look at my neck, look at my debt. Ain't got enough money to pay me respect. Ain't no budget when I'm on the set. If I like it, then that's what I get, yeah.
I want it, I got it, I want it.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKinney.